This is the current federal tax developments for the week of November the 6th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you this week, as always, by the Los Galzo Institute, a Kaplan company, and your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to look at something a little different. We're actually going to take a look at the bill that came out this past week that's known as the Tax Cuts and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Bill. Get the right title there they came up with. Not exactly the most creative title anyone has ever come up with for a tax bill, but it's what we've got. So we'll take a look at that. Now, one of our issues this week is, what exactly do we have here? And we're going to go through this week all the provisions, or not all, but a large chunk of the provisions that are in this bill. But I want to remind you before we do to remember, this bill is not yet law. Almost certainly the United States Senate will, even if the House were to pass this bill with no changes, which is far from certain, the Senate probably will come up with a different bill that they are saying they're going to be releasing sometime this week. And at that point, we'll get to conference committee, get combined. So you don't want to go too far on what we're going to talk about today and assume it's becoming law. But you also want to be aware of what's being proposed, because there is a reasonable chance that something very similar to this could become law. And it's something that your clients are going to want to know about this week. So with that, let's review briefly. Remember, we had a tax reform framework issued. It was issued on September 27th. It was a unified framework for fixing our broken tax code. It was a 9-page document, 6 pages of which had a description of provisions. As I mentioned when that framework came out, the equivalent document that started the Tax Reform Act of 1986, remember this is supposed to be tax reform, was over 450 pages long. So mechanically, we knew we were missing a lot of details. And that's not, you know, that's not really a surprise. We have a lot of things that were to be determined. This week, obviously, we got a lot of those holes filled in. We're going to find out about things. Now, there are some things in here that we haven't mentioned yet that nobody had really talked about. There are other things that pretty much are what we expected. And then there are certain things like the reduction ability to defer to 401k that did not become part of this bill. But what you can tell for sure, just like tax reform, those of us who have been back, who were around in 1986, remember the 86 Act, what you have to recall in this bill, not surprisingly, there'll be things you love and there'll be things you absolutely hate. And the question at the end of the day is going to be, do the things you hate overwhelm the things that you feel are really great? So we'll have to take a look. Now, the actual Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and yes, that was the name, reportedly the president came up with Cut, Cut, Cut as the act name, which sounded like a little strange for a tax bill until you saw what they come up with, and it's like, well, actually, that probably wouldn't have been a whole lot worse. But the bill was released on November 2nd of 2017. What was released that day by the House Ways and Means Committee was an 82-page summary and a 429-page bill. We now have a 300-plus page analysis of the bill from the Joint Committee on Taxation. What I would suggest for anybody looking at this more deeply is, I really suggest you start with the 82-page summary. That'll give you the basic outline. Then, for things that are important to your clients, go ahead and go into the Joint Committee report. The Joint Committee is going to give you a lot of details that simply aren't given to us in the regular main report that we had, in the summary. So there's a lot of interesting details you're going to find there. And then finally, you know, for those things that would appear to be really crucial to a client, you want to actually take a look at the actual language of the bill. Remember, ultimately, at the end of the day, the language in the bill, and not what's in the summary or what's in the Joint Committee report, are what's going to control what happens. Now, I want to remind everybody, I've not had time to actually go through all of these pages. You know, 429 pages of bill, 307 pages of Joint Committee reports, and 82 pages of summary. So, you know, take this with a grain of salt. Anyway, as well, we know these things are going to change. So, you know, just be careful and follow up on anything that appears important to your clients. Our goal today is try to tell you about the things that maybe will be important to your clients that you want to go follow up on and make sure. So we're going to take a look at the highlights today, shall we say, or maybe they're the lowlights. Depends upon how each provision is looked at. And some of them you definitely will feel are lowlights, and some you will definitely feel are highlights. The timetable they're aiming for to get this done, so you know how it's going. They expect to have a House version of the bill passed by mid-November, and then a Senate version as well passed by Thanksgiving. That'd be kind of the idea. So the idea is we're ready to go to conference when they get to the Thanksgiving recess. The conference committee would work through an early part of December, come up with a conference bill. That bill would go back to the Senate and House to be passed. And then if everything goes right, according to their time frame, by Christmas, we expect to have an approved conference bill that is ready for signature by the president. So it's on his desk, as he's phrased it, a Christmas present. So we'll have to see if all of this works. You know, and I think a lot of people have noted, this is a very aggressive timetable. And I want to remind you that back in 1986, it took like 2 years for us to actually get a bill out of this thing that came from the 86 Tax Act. So what they're trying to do is compress in 2 months what took the last time we did something similar 2 years. We'll start out with the basic thing that we talked about before, the standard deduction personal exemptions. They are nearly doubled. For a single individual, the standard deduction will be $12,200. Now, you may remember on the original summary, it was going to be $12,000, but that was using 2017 numbers. Now they're using inflation adjustment moving to 2018. That's why it's slightly different. One thing that we found about instantly as soon as you started reading the summary was there is still going to be a head of household status. That standard deduction will be $18,300. Some people had been concerned at times this had been proposed without that status. Everybody would either have been single or married. We will continue to have head of household. We'll have $24,400 will be a married filing joint return. That'll be for the standard deduction. Now, as was true when we talked about the highlights, you know, that summary they gave us, personal exemptions are gone. So we're not going to have that additional deduction. So as before, the net effect is to raise the zero tax bracket where you wouldn't have to file a return by about 15%. Now, we also this time, though, for sure, did get the tax brackets. And as I suspected, we ended up with four brackets. Remember, we were told we would have three and maybe a fourth if needed. Well, it turns out the fourth one was needed. That fourth bracket is going to remain at 39.6. The other three brackets, we'd already been told, 12%, 25%, 35%. Now, for a married filing joint return, the 25% bracket will start at $90,000. The 35% bracket will start at $260,000. And this is a significant change. The 39.6% bracket for a married couple filing a joint return will rise to $1 million. For head of household, we will end up with a 25% bracket at $67,500, a 35% bracket at $200,000, and a 39.6% bracket that will start at one half of the married filing joint or $500,000. Married separate, again, all the brackets start exactly half of married joint. That's like current law. A single taxpayer will have their married filing joint, will basically have their 25% bracket start at $45,000. Their 35% bracket start at $200,000. And their 39.6% bracket start at $500,000. Estates and trusts, they still have very narrow brackets. An estate will start a 25% bracket at $2,550, 35% bracket at $9,150, and a 39.6% bracket at $12,500. So estates and trusts effectively still get to the max rate at about the same point they would have anyway. Now, one thing they do at this point, though, that is important to understand is they have changed the rules for how they're going to compute the inflation indexing of these numbers. They're going to use the chain CPI. You may have remembered the discussion of that with regard to Social Security and, you know, computing how much that went up each year. This is a smaller increase than before this, so this is a backdoor way of making this law less costly, is by using the chain CPI. They're going to start using that for inflation adjustments throughout the code if this passes. Now, one other big thing, and the Wall Street Journal had an editorial this past weekend that was very critical of this. In fact, they referred to it as the Republican stealth tax proposal. And those of you who remember 1996 and the stealth tax regulations with regard to self-employment tax that Newt Gingrich, you know, christened them, those are loaded words that I believe the Wall Street Journal knew exactly what they meant by those words. There is going to be a special bubble rate that is meant to eliminate the benefit of the 12% bracket for high-income taxpayers. The tax will be increased by 6% of the excess of a taxpayer's adjusted gross income over the applicable dollar amount. This applicable dollar amount will be $1.2 million for a married filing joint return, $1 million for somebody who is filing you know, another filing status. So you put 6% on top of 39.6, it is a 45.6% bracket. That means that we actually now have a higher bracket than we had under prior law. Now you can argue that some, because with phase outs, you may have, for practical purposes, had a bracket, you know, somebody whose marginal, effective marginal rate was higher than the 39.6. But in reality, we never had a pure rate. And it's not as if some of those phase outs aren't going to stay around anyway. So this is a little bit of, some people have complained about this, certainly the Wall Street Journal coming out and pointing it out, would not be good news. Certainly a lot of people be upset. Not sure if this will stay around. Obviously, they needed it for some money, and it sounds good to get rid of the 12% bracket for those that are wealthy. I guess that's kind of a PR move. So any event, this is in the bill, so watch out for that special bubble bracket. Now, once you've worked your way through and it's capped at the lesser of 27.6% of the taxpayer's taxable income or the amount to get up to 25% threshold amount. And you might say, wait, how could it be 27.6% of taxable income? Remember, this is not keyed by taxable income. This is keyed by AGI. So somebody who, at least in theory, had a ton of charitable contributions, maybe for hurricane relief, if we continue that next year, so they basically almost wiped out their income, could still end up with this problem of having the 27.6% additional add-on tax. So remember, this is AGI. This is not based on taxable income. That also means that capital gains can serve to push you into this special 6% tax bracket. Now, going on to capital gains do not go up. The rates there did not follow the other rates. By that I mean that the 20% bracket does not wait till 39.6 kicks in. It kicks in a much lower level. Kicks in a level that's basically where it does now. So for a married couple filing a joint return, they have a 0% bracket up to $77,200. At $77,200, they start paying at 15%. And at $479,000, they start paying at 20%. Head of household, 51.7 is where the 15% bracket starts. $452,400 is where the 20% bracket starts. If it's a married filing separate taxpayer, half of the married joint, just like normal. For a single taxpayer, 33.6 is where you start the 15% rate. $425,800 is where you start the 20% bracket. And for an estate or trust, $2,600 is where the 15% bracket starts, and $12,700 is where the 20% bracket starts. So a little bit different on the capital gains brackets, and they did not go up. So it did not take the capital gains brackets, which I think is the big news. You don't get to go all the way to $1 million before the 20% rate will kick in. Now we also have kiddie tax reform. It's no longer going to be tied to the parents' tax rates. It's going to be taxed at the rates for trusts and estates without benefits of the 12% bracket. Only taxable income in excess of net unearned income will be taxed at 12% for the kid. So this is a radical change in how the kiddie tax works. Okay, so no longer do mom and dad manage. The kids are just going to basically be taxed as if they were a trust or estate. And they're going to only be able to use the 12% bracket to the extent they have earned income. So that's kind of how we work now, except what it does mean is, even if mom and dad aren't anywhere near 39.6, the kid can get to 39.6 fairly quickly under this proposal. The alternative minimum tax, it is repealed. But don't celebrate too much, because various things that currently are part of the AMT will start showing back up in the regular tax. So keep your eyes open for that. Minimum tax credit carryovers, you can claim the minimum tax credit carryover against your income taxes now to wipe that out. But if you can't use it up that way, you'll get to use 50% of whatever is unused in 2019. And then you'll get 50% again of whatever is unused the next 2 years, so that's half of the remainder. And then finally, the balance will be refunded 2022. So if we wipe out your regular tax and we still have minimum tax credit, beginning in 2019, you'll be getting a refund of part of that minimum tax credit. And the law is set up to assure that we're going to wash this out by 2022. Now, one thing to note, getting rid of the AMT has a price tag of over $700 billion. That suggests that if they have to look for offsets, this worries me some, that if they start putting things back in as people complain, this could be a place to get a lot of money. That's concerning because the AMT could come back in that scenario. The PEAS limitation will no longer be there on itemized deductions. Remember, that's the phase out of itemized deductions. We get rid of that. Of course, we're getting rid of most itemized deductions, but, you know, hey, what can I say? Mortgage interest. This is a significant change. Mortgage interest will only be allowed on debts up to $500,000, reduced from $1 million. There'll be no deduction for home equity indebtedness either under this rule. Now, debts incurred before November 2nd of 2017, which is when this was announced, are grandfathered. They'll be under the old rules. But any new debts will be stuck. Also, you will not be able to claim a deduction for mortgage interest on a second residence. That's another major change in the law. So no second residence is allowed. That, you know, that's going to cause a problem for some clients. Real estate taxes will be the only state and local tax allowed on Schedule A. And the real estate taxes will be capped at $10,000. So if you have more than $10,000 of real estate taxes, you'll only be able to claim $10,000. As you may have heard, the home building industry, the realtors are against this bill. Major reason they're against it is twofold. Number one, the doubling of the standard deduction. And number two, these limitations on mortgage interest and real estate taxes. The estimate that I had seen in the Wall Street Journal suggested that we would go from about 21% of taxpayers getting a tax benefit for owning a home down to 4%, because the doubling of the standard deduction would wipe out a good chunk. And then also we've got these reductions. So we already have those two, plus a few others that are against it. The architects are against it. We've got all kinds of people, everybody, because there are definitely things here you're not going to like. Just understand that. Casualty losses. Generally, we're going to repeal the deduction for personal casualty losses, but they did write in a special exception for any hurricane losses that came from Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, or Maria. Nothing yet in here says anything about California wildfires, because they were not covered in that special congressional bill. We'll see if that gets written in. We'll see if there's some special rules there. But right now, it would only allow those. In theory, future disasters would be non-deductible for any casualty losses unless Congress went back and revised the code to put a special rule in. All gambling expenses, and not just wagering losses, will be limited to gambling income as a deduction. So we're not going to be able to, you know, professional gamblers will definitely be triggered by that. We're going to end up losing some issues. Charitable contributions, there are some significant issues here. We still get them, but here's the catch. Well, the first change is a good change, at least if your client gives lots to charity. We're going to raise the percentage limit for AGI from 50 to 60%. That's good news if you make large contributions. However, next thing, not so good. Currently, you get an 80% deduction if you pay for athletic seating rights, college athletics. You know, they go, they pay for things. I know in the Phoenix area, we see people at the Sun Devil Club who are buying seating rights and get the 80% deduction. Those deductions will go away. You cannot claim that deduction. The charitable mileage rate will be indexed for inflation. Well, okay, good news. See, we're trading off good news, bad news here. So that'll be indexed. Don't know if that's going to be a big deal, but it will be indexed for inflation going forward, so it will change. Now, here's where things get not so fun. Currently, you must have contemporaneous acknowledgement, which says also you didn't get anything, right? You have to have it before the return is filed for a gift of $250 or more. They're going to remove the $250. You will need that for a $1 charitable contribution. You are going to need that contemporaneous acknowledgement before the return is filed. That's not necessarily a good thing. You're going to have documentation to that detail and everything. They also removed the option in the law, because IRS never did get around to writing regs, to have the charity report the gift on for substantiation purposes. The IRS never wrote regs for that. Some people tried various ways to get around it. They're just going to pull it from the law now. You've got to get that letter from the charity before the return is filed, and you need it for every single charitable contribution, period. Okay. Hey, this will get close to home. We're going to repeal the deduction for tax preparation expenses below the line. So you're not going to get that deduction. No deduction for medical expenses. That could impact a few. Again, I don't have many clients that are impacted, but I have a few that will be really impacted because they have large medical expenses. They're not going to get a deduction for that. Okay, that's out of the grind. Big change here. We are going to repeal the deduction for alimony payments and the income inclusion for alimony on post-2017 degrees, and modifications of those degrees indicate they're basically going for the new law. So again, no alimony deduction, no alimony income. Now for for 2017 earlier decrees, we'll still use the rules we have now. But beginning in 2018, alimony is a thing of the past for tax purposes. We're going to repeal the deduction for moving expenses. We're going to finally kill off medical savings accounts. You can't contribute to them any longer. What they're trying to do is move you to HSAs. I always wondered why it wasn't killed off when we first started the program. I didn't just simply modify the MSA rules to be what HSAs are. But now we're going to officially say, hey, we don't see a valid reason to have an MSA, so we're going to just get HSAs. We're going to repeal the deduction for all employee business, from almost all employee business expenses, including those of teachers. The only ones that will still be allowed are those for in the Armed Service Reserves. Though that above the line deduction will stay, all other above the line deductions and below the line of deductions for employee business expenses will be gone. So all of the below the lines are out there. As we said, the teachers are gone. You can, however, still exclude expenses reimbursed under a qualified expense reimbursement program by your employer. So obviously, reimbursement programs become important. Also means, though, if your program is found to be non-qualifying, it's going to really damage things badly, because not only will we have to pick that up as, you know, for payroll tax purposes, the employee is going to get no deduction whatsoever, regardless of what their other old miscellaneous itemized would have looked like. We're going to limit the exclusion for employer-provided housing. A maximum of $50,000 will be allowed, $25,000 married filing separate, and it's going to phase out $120,000, which is the bigger one. It's going to be much more difficult to get the exclusion for the sale of your residence. This is a major change. The ownership and use rules. You must own and you must use it as your principal residence for 5 of the prior 8 years. That's up dramatically from 2 of the prior 5. You can only use it once every 5 years. And this is a big one. It's going to phase out as a taxpayer's AGI exceeds $500,000, $250,000 for married filing separate, on a dollar-for-dollar basis. So a taxpayer with over $1 million of adjusted gross income will not be able to exclude a gain on a sale of a residence, period. None of it will be excludable. Municipal bonds, we're going to start taxing some of those. First thing is, newly issued private activity bonds will be subject to federal income taxation, borrowing that from the AMT. We're also going to require tax to be paid on bonds that are used to build professional sports stadiums that are issued after the introduction of the bill. Congress doesn't like that. By the way, that's something you'll see through this bill a few times too. Congress is going after state and local governments subsidizing various businesses. Certain employee benefits will become taxable. That includes employee achievement awards. Dependent care assistance programs will now be taxable to the employee. Qualified moving expense reimbursements will be taxable. And adoption assistance programs. Okay. We're going to accelerate the taxation of non-qualified deferred compensation. That's going to be popular. It will now become taxable basically at the same point it's FICA taxable, when there's no substantial risk of forfeiture. And by that they mean there is no longer a requirement you perform future services to earn this. There's not what will not be considered a substantial risk of forfeiture will be any sort of future covenant not to compete. As well, you're not going to be able to get out of this by claiming in your document this is something other than compensation. Sorry, we're just going to tax it. It'll cover services rendered after 2017. Any comp you've already earned prior to 17, you basically have 10 years to get it out. That'll be grandfathered till 2026. There are special rules that will allow you to modify your non-qualified deferred comp to get a payout before 26 if there wasn't going to be one. But in 2026, after that, any remaining non-qualified deferred comp from 2017 earlier is going to be taxed. Yes, you don't have cash. No, that doesn't matter. Retirement program changes are made. There's no more option to recategorize Roth IRA contributions or rollovers as traditional contributions. Congress felt that was being abused, so they're going to get rid of that. In-service distributions for a defined benefit plan can begin at age 59 and a half. right? Currently, it was limited to defined contribution plans and to certain government plans. This will expand that. You can allow those taking hardship distributions to continue to contribute to a plan. Currently, they have to basically keep from contributing for 6 months afterwards. And the plans could allow earnings and employer contributions to be part of a hardship distribution if you want to modify your plan. Rollovers for deemed plan distributions are extended to the due date of the employee's tax returns when an employee gets a distribution because of a loan. You know, when they had an outstanding loan, they left the employer, $10,000 of the account was the loan, so the employer treats that as a distribution. Now they will have till the due date of their tax return to roll it over. That's because quite often they don't even know where there is a thing should be rolled over until such time as they see one of us and we say, that 1099-R, you're going to have to pay tax on that. And they say they didn't get any cash. It's like, well, it doesn't really matter. Child tax credit will be increased to $1,600. Immediately, $1,000 of it would be potentially refundable under rules similar today to the additional child tax credit. Eventually, it phases up to get all refundable. The dependent will add a new dependent tax and family tax credit of $300 for each non-child dependent or other non-dependent, like the taxpayer and spouse. But that rule will only stay around for 3 years or for 5 years, and it won't be refundable. It's only effective through 2022. And all of these phase out if your AGI gets above certain levels. Education credits, we're going to go down to only the American Opportunity Tax Credit. We're going to get rid of the HOPE credit and the Lifetime Learning credit. It'll be 100% credit on the first 2,000, 25% credit on the next 2,000. And we'll have a fifth year you can use it at one half of the rate of the first 4 years, you know, with up to $500 being refundable. Other savings rules will change. Coverdell ESA contributions will no longer be allowed. You can keep running your old ESA, but you cannot put more money into it. You can roll them into 529s, and that's what they're really aiming for here, is to set up a 529 plan, because up to $10,000 of elementary and high school expenses now could be paid out of the 529. The unique thing about Coverdell ESAs was they could be ESAs, is they could be used to pay for elementary and high school expenses for private elementary school. Now suddenly we're going to be able to use it even for, you know, the 529 numbers can be used for that. So that got rid of really the need for the Coverdell fund. Funds may also be used for certain expenses in registered apprenticeship programs. Don't know how much use that'll get. And you now can establish, you could establish a 529 plan for your unborn child. Now, that does have to be one, you know, where somebody is truly expecting. It's not just, well, I think we're going to have a kid in 4 years, so we're going to start funding it now. Now, that doesn't count at this point. And it has one of the weirdest definitions. They had to define what an unborn child was. So that's, it's kind of an interesting read about, you know, we even had to define it has to be Homo sapiens, which had me wondering what do they think was going to be in that category. But okay, we'll take it from there. We repeal entirely the deduction for student loan interest, the tuition and fees deductions, the ability to use tax-free interest with a tax-free make use of interest tax-free on U.S. savings bonds for education. Qualified tuition reductions by employers will no longer be allowed. Neither will we have an exclusion for employer-provided educational assistance. Those will all be gone. We're going to eliminate a bunch of credits. The over 65 credit on Schedule R, which I never actually saw used, but that'll be eliminated. The adoption credit is defunct. The mortgage credit certificate credit is defunct. The credit for a qualified electric plug-in vehicle will go away. We're going to modify and phase out the residential energy efficient property credit. The credit is extended to all qualified property placed in service prior to 2022. We'll have reduced rates coming up in the future. 26% for property placed in service during 2020, 22% for property placed in service during 2021, at which point the credit goes away. The estate and GST taxes, we're going to go through a two-tiered step here. First, the exclusion will initially be raised to $10 million index for inflation. Then, beginning in 2023, the estate and GST taxes will be repealed. So no more estate, no more generation skipping transfer tax in 2023. But even then, this time, unlike what we had under AGTRA, we're going to retain step-up in basis for inherited property even without the estate tax. That's nice because lack of step-up in basis is really tough to figure out what the original basis of the property was. Corporate tax rates. This is the big thing for this bill. This is really the aim of the bill, to be totally honest. A single flat 20% tax rates. Now, I would note this would be an increase for a small C corporation that has income below $50,000 because they were currently paying 15. But for most other corporations, this is going to be a rather significant tax decrease. Personal service corporations' rates will be set now down to 25%. So they won't go as low as 20, but they will go to 25. So if you have a personal service corporation, the numbers are lower now at 25%. And now, interesting, significantly lower than the top individual tax rate for earnings. Now for what's going to be the real interesting thing, I think where we're going to spend a lot of time if this passes, the pass-through business 25% rate for individuals. It would apply to proprietorship, partnerships, and S-corporations. Not only applies to business income. That's important, right? And it does not apply to the amount of that income that represents what they consider to be a labor factor. Now, what's interesting, and I've talked to a couple of people who at first, looked twice at this one, but if it's determined that you are a passive investor, you're going to get the 25% rate on every dollar flowing to you. So if you do not materially participate, then it's assumed that your entire return is based on a return on capital. 100% will be eligible for the 25% rate. If you do materially participate, now things get a little more interesting. You can use, for most activities, we'll talk about one big exception, you can use a 30% safe harbor rate. So if you actively participate in your S corporation, and yet the S corporation K-1 shows $100,000 of income, we will treat $30,000 of that as subject to 25% and $70,000 as not eligible for the special rate, so potentially paying 39.6 on that 70%. As an alternative, we have a capital rate option. Now, if you elect to use this, you're basically required to keep using it for the following four tax years. So once you opt into this, you're stuck with it for basically five returns. You compute a rate of return of 7% plus the federal short-term rate, and you multiply that by capital invested in the business. Capital invested in the business will be computed based on essentially the asset balance will be the adjusted basis of the property using the activity at the end of the taxable year, not taking into account a basis adjustment for bonus depreciation or Section 179. So you'll multiply the capital rate, 7% plus the short-term AFR, which is, you'll get maybe 8%, times the asset balance that we just computed there. That's essentially your adjusted basis of property you have at the end of the year after taking out bonus depreciation 179 issues. Then you will need to subtract any interest expenses allowed, and we're going to talk about limitations on that. But that will give you your 25% income. Now remember, it may work out great for you this year, but you're going to be stuck with this for the next 5 years if for some reason your income goes up dramatically, but your capital doesn't go up dramatically. You could find that that five-year election was disadvantageous. So it's going to be one of those to take, to question. Also, obviously on exam, one of the key things you're going to have to prove is every asset on the depreciation schedule actually was in existence at the end of the year. The mere fact, I'm sure more than a few companies have assets on depreciation schedule, especially with 179, it's fully depreciated. They're not doing GAAP financials for anybody. They don't really care. The depreciation schedule has maybe a lot of old beat up assets that they don't care about. The property tax issues may not be too bad for them. Don't be surprised on exam that you may get stuck with having to prove those assets are really there if you've elected the capital rate method. Now, personal service businesses cannot use the 30% option. They essentially have to use the capital contribution. That, and now the personal service corporations will be all the standard ones that give PSC treatment, which will include accounting firms and law firms and medical practices, architects, all that standard sort of stuff. Plus anybody else where, the reputation of the person is a major component of what generates the income. So they will have to use, if they want to use the capital, that'll be the only way to do it with invested capital. And remember, invested capital does not count any cash on hand. We're talking about actual equipment you're buying. So we can use that calculation. And they did say they're going to have additional anti-abuse rules to prevent wages from being reclassified as 24% income. Okay, this is just going to be a mess to deal with. But it's going to be one of the best-known parts of this. Obviously, if we can move income from 39.6 to 25, that's a major advantage. This is where all the fun's going to be under these rules. The 25% rate would also apply to certain dividends of REITs, real estate investment trusts. Now, a couple of other quirks of a self-employment tax are going to really change self-employment tax. The self-employment tax will apply to the labor portion of flow-through incomes. Now, for a partnership, that's probably good news for the active partners, because currently 100% of their flow-through income be subject to SE, you know, assuming that they're not considered a limited partner. By the way, we're getting rid of the exception for limited partners, so they're going to be tested here. The other neat thing about this is we're also going to get rid of the exception for rental real estate and rental of property leased with real estate. That'll also be technically subject to SE tax, at least to the extent that there's a labor component there. And we would also apply self-employment tax to the labor portion of the S corporation flow-through income. Now, how this is going to work for S corporations is we're going to take the income coming off the S return, and we're also going to consider as part of our labor return the salary they took. So you're going to add those two together, then you multiply by 30, and the 30, you know, you can't convert salary into non-salary this way. But you would compare the computed 30 amount to your total flow-through income, and you'd get the lesser of the flow-through income, or the 30 would be your 25% income. But if your flow-through income is greater than the 30% or the capital account allowance, that's now going to be subject to self-employment tax. And what that means is all the people that got an S corporation and the only reason they have it is to avoid SE tax, well, that's not going to work so well anymore. So I would expect we are going to see a lot fewer S corporations if this goes through, because at this point, there's no huge advantage in having an S corporation over having an LLC taxed as a partnership. And there, as if you've ever taken a course from me regarding S corporations and partnerships, you'll know that my belief always has been that there's very little to recommend an S corporation versus a partnership aside from that SE issue. With the SE issue out of there, yeah, we may see a lot fewer S's. We also have other issue. If you have a loss from the business this year, but let's say, you know, that loss offset, you know, you had a loss of $10,000. You had other income, your spouse had wages. So, you know, we actually got to deduct all that this year. We're still going to hold on to that 10. And next year, that 10 is going to reduce the amount of the 25% business income that you can take. So we're going to reduce how much can be the 25% rate. So if you had losses, we're going to have to wipe those losses out with the business income standing alone. Again, it doesn't matter that there's no NOL coming forward. That's not the issue. You're going to have to carry that business loss to the next year, and that's going to reduce how much you can take a 25% rate on. Okay. Cost recovery, you're going to have a bonus depreciation for qualified property placed in service. It's 100% bonus is basically the issue here. It has to be after September 27th of 2017. Yes, that is this year. So this one would be this one would come into 17. And placed in service before January 1st of 2023. This goes away. We no longer have the original use requirement for the bonus depreciation. Rather, it just has to be the first use of the property by the taxpayer or related parties. That means used property qualifies for this for the most part. Taxpayer's first use is the only concern here. Now, the additional first-year bonus depreciation for a car is raised from $8,000 to $16,000. There are a couple of exceptions. Not qualifying for this would be property used in a regulated utility or property used in a real property trade or business. Now, the next one's interesting, and I think it's in here primarily because they expect a lot of states not to adopt bonus in this case. But Section 179 is increased to $5 million annually. Well, that's great, except most of what we buy will qualify for bonus. So you'd wonder, do you really need 179? Because remember, the bonus isn't capped at all. Well, you may need it because if your state doesn't adopt the bonus depreciation, you might need to use 179 if your state conforms there. So we'll have to watch that. The phase out rises to $20 million worth of acquisitions. You might say, well, wait, but the bonus goes away after 5 years, so that's why it's here. No, it's going to go away after 5 years. but it would include qualified energy efficient heating and cooling equipment effective November 2nd of 17 would be qualified for 179. So that's kind of interesting. And again, but it kicks back in 2023. The other explanation for this is Congress has never allowed 179 to really kick back down. So maybe their theory is even if bonus doesn't get extended, this would. So this is kind of the long-term thing that they would give for small businesses. It's kind of their protection, right? As we said, but it's, as it stands initially, at least, it's not that big a deal because a whole bunch of things that currently we are using 179 for will now qualify for bonus, and the bonus is 100%. And unlike 179, bonus can create losses. Now, we have a number of neat small business accounting rules that I think you're going to like. We're going to have a $25 million threshold rather than $5 million for having C corporations report on the accrual basis. So that's nice, 25. And, you know, we also can use them with inventories. Any business up to $25 million of annual gross receipts can be cash basis now, and even if they keep inventories, if they're a significant part of the business. So the cash basis could be used by all such businesses except tax shelters. So a lot of your small business clients are going to be able to go on the cash basis if they want to. Business with gross receipts of less than $25 million will also be exempt from the UNICAP rules. That's a nicety. And the $10 million long-term contract rules for construction contractors where they have to go percentage of completion, that would be raised to $25 million. So you have a lot more small contractors. Again, neat small business accounting issue reforms. Those I think most of us are going to like. And gross receipts of less than $25 million are also exempt from the interest limitations, which we'll get to here in just a second. But below $25 million, you have a lot of nice things happening in these accounting rules. So you may want to take a look there. Now let's talk about that net interest deduction limitation. Net interest, which is interest expense in excess of interest income, in excess of 30% of a business's adjusted taxable income, which is taxable income before interest, will be disallowed. It is computed at the filer level, so it will be a partnership or S corporation computation. You don't make this computation at the individual equity holder level. Disallowed interest will be carried forward for up to 5 years. If it's unused at the end of 5 years, you just lose that interest, right? There are a couple of exemptions. Small businesses, those under $25 million, are exempted from these rules. Regulated utilities are exempted, as are real property, trades, or businesses. Those all don't have to worry about these net interest limitations. The reason for the last two is this was the trade-off for allowing you to immediately expense. So those industries cannot immediately expense, but because of that, they don't face the interest trade-off. Net operating losses are going to be limited and are going to change dramatically for the worse. You can only offset 90% of taxable income with an NOL carryover. We're going to adopt the AMT rule. Generally, we're going to repeal all carrybacks, so we won't have any loss carrybacks anymore, except for a one-year carryback for certain casualty and disaster losses of small businesses. That'll be a $5 million three-year average annual gross receipts test for a small business or farms. And the only casualty losses, right? Regular old losses won't qualify. One trade-off, because we can only carry them forward, we're now actually going to have to add an interest factor each year. So they're going to let us write up the NOL by an interest factor to supposedly compensate us for not being able to take the NOL, right away. Okay. Like-kind exchanges, it can only be used for real property under these rules, right? A special rule will apply to exchanges in process at the end of 2017. They can be completed. So if you've either acquired the replacement property or you have sold the property to be disposed of, the property to be exchanged, you can complete that transaction if it's open at the end of 17. But after that, no like-kind exchange for personal property. We're going to repeal the exclusion for capital contributions to a corporation. We had those capital contributions. Let's say a locality makes a contribution to the capital of a corporation, doesn't get any stock. That used to be excludable from income. If you're a corporation, that's going to be gone from the code. There'll also be no deduction for local lobbying expenses, right? The 199 deduction For domestic production activity deduction, that will also be a thing of the past. That's gone. We will have no deduction allowed for entertainment, amusement, or recreational activities. Remember those 50% items? Nothing. They will be gone to zero. There will be no deduction for transportation fringe benefits or on-premises gym and athletic facilities or amenities provided to an employee that are personal in nature. You will still be able to get 50% of food and beverage payments and qualifying meals. Okay, that will still be allowed, right? And one other neat thing, any of those employee benefits that are disallowed will be added to unrelated business income tax for a tax-exempt entity. Self-created patents, inventions, models, or designs are no longer eligible to be treated as a capital asset under this law. That would repeal the elective capital gain treatment for musical compositions and copyrights in music works. And it would also repeal Section 1235, so a sale of patent rights will be tested under the standard test for any assets to see if that sale is a capital asset. So we're getting rid of capital gain treatment for a lot of these intangibles that are being created. The special rule that allowed them to be treated as capital gain assets if they were sold. So we're going to have a lot more ordinary income on these items. We're going to get rid of technical terminations for partnerships, which probably a lot of you will be happy about that. No longer have that issue about 50% interest. But what's interesting is that the Joint Committee on Taxation actually scores this as raising revenue. Most likely, the assumption is that some partnerships had been intentionally getting a terminating event in place to change various elections that they wanted to change to a more favorable structure. When you terminate, a whole bunch of elections become open again. The Congress apparently decided that that was costing them money. They don't like losing that money, so they're going to shut down technical terminations. Plain old regular terminations will still continue as before. Number of business credits are repealed, the credit for clinical testing expenses for drugs for rare diseases or conditions. The credit for employer-provided child care will be gone. The rehabilitation credit will go away. The work opportunity tax credit, the deduction for certain unused business credits will also be gone from the law. The new markets tax credit will be gone. And the credit to provide access to disabled individuals. All of these business credits will go away beginning in 2018. The tip credit is going to be modified. So if you have restaurants, realize this. The amount above which the credit is allowed is going to be tied now to the minimum wage instead of using the wage that was in place back in January of 2007, which is what it's currently tied to. And all employers, not just those with more than 10 employees, that are claiming this credit would have to report their tip allocations to employees to the IRS. So there'll be more reporting required. Finally, another major change to change the worldwide taxation system. This I'm going to cover very briefly. So if you're really into this, this is where you want to go dig through the documents. We're going to replace the current system with a dividend exemption system for corporations. So there'll be 100% exemptions for dividends of a foreign subsidiary as long as you own at least 10% of the subsidiary. There'll be no foreign tax credit allowed, though, on any of these exempt dividends. And no tax on foreign earnings on reinvestments in U.S. property. We'll get rid of that. Now, if you have any of these dividends you receive that are exempt, it will reduce your basis in the shares of that company, of that foreign subsidiary, but only for purposes of computing a loss. It will not affect computation of a gain if you dispose of that entity. In order to transition to this system, we're going to tax the accumulated earnings and profits of the foreign entity in which a taxpayer owns more than 10% interest. The amount of that E&P that is deemed to come from cash equivalents will be taxed at 12%. The remainder will be taxed at 5%. It will be by election payable over up to 8 years by the company. So that'll be your choice coming in. Now, what are the prospects for the bill? Well, obviously, we're moving it via reconciliation, which failed on repeal and replace. That we have to worry about. The advantage why they want to do that is Republicans do not need Democratic support for this bill if they use reconciliation. Otherwise, in the Senate, you need to get at least 8 Democrats to come along to allow it to go to a vote. And that's under, because you have to have cloture. The cloture rules say that you have to have 60 votes to close debate. And they're probably not going to get those 60. If the Democrats don't want the bill to go through. So they're using this method. But it does have disadvantages, and those you need to be worried about here. The first disadvantage is the 10-year cliff problem of the Byrd Rule. They cannot create larger deficits more than 10 years out. Because of that, when this bill gets to the Senate, don't be surprised if a lot of these items, the ones that are, quote, good news, go away after 10 years. We're back to like AGTRA, because AGTRA was moved via reconciliation method, which had the same problem, right? We've got that. Also, they're going to need virtually unanimous Republican backing. They can only lose 22 votes with vacancies, illnesses now, right now, 22 votes. If they lose 22 votes in the House, it will fail. So they cannot lose that much. In the Senate, the margin's even tighter. If they have three Republican senators vote against the bill, it will fail, assuming no Democrats vote for it. So we again need virtually unanimous Republican support. Currently, we've not heard any Republican really come out against it, except for Peter King of New York, who says he would be for it, except for the repeal of the state and local tax deduction. That is probably the biggest objection right now. We have some Republican representatives, especially from the New Jersey and New York areas, that are upset and going against this. You'd also probably see some throw in from California and a few other states. But the question is, will they actually get in the way and block this? That's not clear. Not enough of them did to stop this from moving forward this far when they passed the budget resolution. We again have to watch carefully. What I would suggest you want to do is watch over the next couple of weeks and see if they start getting close to the timetable they're setting, or whether objection starts coming up, they start renegotiating the bill. If that starts happening, things may not go so well, because this is one of those things, if you pull on one thread here, everything can unravel very quickly. Because let's say that the home builders get the credit they want for mortgage interest. Well, suddenly another group comes in, like the doctors, and say, well, I want the 25% pass-through. And if you start doing that, you start doing this, we make all these changes, suddenly, okay, it's not going to fit the budget. Now we have to go back, okay, put the AMT back in. Suddenly, things may not look so good. So keep your eye carefully on this. We do have opponents already cropped up. We mentioned the home builders and realtors. They're already against it for the reasons I mentioned. The Wall Street Journal gave an editorial on stealth tax, and they also called it half reform, because unlike most Republican proposals in the past for tax reform or for tax cuts, this one does not drop the top personal rate. That's something they've always done. That doesn't happen this time. The legislative exposures, we need to watch in the House, the Freedom Caucus and the Tuesday group. They have very different ideas about issues. Right now, it looks as if the Freedom Caucus and the Tuesday group are backing the proposal for now. But if they start sniping, or more to the point, if it appears that one of them gets some special deal, don't be surprised the other wants a deal as well. There are enough blocks, there are enough votes in both of those groups to block it. So watch them there. We get to the Senate. Various senators may have issues and may have conflicting issues, and they may have, in essence, conflicting issues that they need resolved for their votes. I think you have to watch some of the same people who became tough votes in the health care debate. Those same senators may very well be tough votes in this debate. Just keep your eyes on them. It'll be an interesting run to see what happens. Again, we need to watch this. There's no guarantee it becomes law. It's probably, if it does become law, there will be some significant changes, but this would be a massive change in the law, very much, you know, the biggest change clearly since the 86 Act. So from that standpoint, I think you need to make sure that you have considered, if these things went through, which clients do you have that these things would really affect? I think you need to begin to start talking to clients about the fact that these proposals are out there and what it could do to them. And not necessarily taking steps that only make sense if this law passes, but start considering also whether you want to take a step that would be irreversible and would be a bad step if this law passes. You know, you've got to start playing a bit of uncertainty. If we're lucky, we'll have the answer to the uncertainty before the end of December. If we're not lucky, and I think that's very possible, we may not know going into 2018 what 2018 tax law will be. That could be interesting as well. We hope you've enjoyed this week's special presentation of current federal tax developments.